This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, the author of the new book, Partisans, follows a trajectory of the Republican Party that led to President Trump and the GOP politicians and pundits now vying for his mantle. Now, the U.S. economy officially made up all of the jobs it lost during the pandemic last month, but the labor market is still tight. Our next guest says part of the reason is that the share of people working or looking for work still has not recovered to pre-pandemic levels, and that means there are fewer workers competing for open jobs. But where did all those workers go? We'll ask our guest about that and hear what a smaller workforce means for the people who are still in it, businesses and the economy. And you can join us at any time during this conversation, 1-800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Did you retire during the pandemic, maybe a little earlier than expected? Did you leave your job because it wasn't fulfilling anymore? Did you find a gig job instead of a full-time job is better for you and your hours and just your living? Let us know. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Lydia DePillis. She's a business reporter for the New York Times. And Lydia, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
I'm happy to be here.
So take us back to the start of the pandemic. We lose 22 million jobs and this supply of labor. How many people are in the workforce? What has happened to that supply since then?
Right. So as you said, the number of jobs did reach its pre-pandemic high, I think, in July, and it exceeded that again last month. And yet, the share of the American population that is working or looking for work hasn't reached the same level. So the in pure numbers, it works out, just to be clear, and that's how people are able to fill the jobs. But the population has expanded even more. So that doesn't bode well for sort of future productivity and economic growth when you have more people who are not working and fewer people who are working. So that's the challenge that a lot of policymakers see right now.
And Lydia, let's begin with retirements. I mentioned that before. What did we see in terms of workers moving towards retirement and even those who weren't actually at retirement age yet?
That's right. So in trying to figure out what was going on here, I broke down labor force participation by a bunch of different metrics, including age. And the age group that has declined the most and failed to recover, and I don't mean that in any kind of like pejorative way, they just haven't, is folks over 65. And you might think, well, their retirement age, why does it matter? And it's actually interesting that folks past retirement age had been working at higher rates in the years prior to the pandemic, because folks are living longer, maybe their savings aren't stretching as longer, people are healthier, at least they were before the pandemic. So that's a reversal of that trend. And the folks, you know, just before retirement age, probably were seeing some drop off around 62, 63. The earlier ones have mostly come back, like the 55s to 61s or so. And so that's a number of factors, right? Like, I think that COVID probably pushed people into retirement at the same time that they saw their assets rise. If you had any kind of stock portfolio or a house, which again, I mean, plenty of people do not have, but those who are lucky enough to have those things saw, well, if I rein in my spending and maybe downsize my house, I can quit a few years early and it's going to be okay. And then of course, most in-person workplaces became a lot scarier, especially for older people. So I think that is going to take a while to recover. And it's a real hit to a lot of companies to have lost that institutional knowledge. And a lot of these folks are really experienced. So it is a blow to lose these older workers.
It's interesting as we bring this up and the callers start coming in, Lydia, what we're about ready to hear. Let's turn first to Dave in Madison, who joins us with Lydia DePillis from the New York Times. Dave, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
What's your story?
So I am a physician who retired after 26 years of practice at age 56, a little earlier than I planned to. And I think the pandemic maybe brought some issues into clearer focus, but there are also some management issues. A lot of people say never fail to take advantage of a crisis, but there was some pinching of the medical providers and lots of changes that were not very attractive to me to continue working, and had the finances to retire and just decided it was time.
And where are you at on that decision today, Dave? Do you got a lot of free time on your hands? Have you found other ways to, you know, put your skills to work?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, everyone asks you, what are you going to do? And I've really not had that problem. I'm pretty active, and I kind of decided that I wanted to retire before I wasn't healthy enough to enjoy it. And I think one of the comments that your expert made is, you know, the shame in this is that the experience, the lack of experience, you know, I got better in my job as I got older.
Right.
There really wasn't an appreciation for that experience, at least in my opinion. And I think they could replace me with someone who was a little cheaper, but probably not as, I mean, not to be egotistical, but not as good at that stage in their career. And that scares me a little bit. I don't think that we value experience enough.
Dave, I very much appreciate the call. And yes, there is, Lydia, this idea that with people retiring a little bit early, like Dave did at 56 as a physician, there would be some institutional history that may be lost. There obviously some experience that goes by the wayside. But what effect did this wave of retirements have on some of these industries that older workers were in?
Well, I mean, Dave, I'm glad that you called in because this is absolutely a huge problem in the healthcare sector, right? I mean, it's not just in the physician ranks, but also in nursing. And so it's a really scary place to be in when you're not sure your hospital can offer the staffing levels that you would need to keep to stay safe, basically. And, you know, and I think that loss of physicians matters, especially in rural areas. So, I've heard a lot about the changes in the healthcare system, consolidation, private equity ownership, that have worsened working conditions, and that is a big problem, along with the sort of ageism that exists, you know, more broadly. And to your question, I it's a problem in many fields where the workforce is aging, and they can't afford to lose anybody, let alone their most experienced people. So we see a teacher shortage now, you know, a lot of longtime teachers just saying, like, forget it. I mean, young teachers too. Government service is something that's a very old field in many places. Even things, something like construction, you'd be surprised, and farming. A lot of knowledge in those, you know, 50 years and up kind of people. And if they decide to just bail, then it is a serious problem.
Yeah. And if this, we had Dan, we had another caller earlier who retired early as a teacher. I think it was Danny called us, and because of the pandemic and other factors in schools, he said he misses his students, but he's happy about the decision he made. You also talked to Thomas, who worked in healthcare. Tell us about his story, Lydia.
Oh, so yeah, he actually, Tom Strait from Florida, he left a career in restaurants, and he actually switched in his 50s and went through several years of school, some remedial college even, to become a cardiac sonographer, which is something that's really a valuable specialty. And he actually left the workforce in December 2019 when his hospital asked him to move closer by to be on call. And he's like, I don't want to do that. And then COVID hit. And so he just said, you know, screw it. It's not worth it to me to continue in this field, as much as he enjoyed it. You know, he downsized and moved to Florida, and he thinks that he could totally still healthy. He could pick that up again and start working somewhere, because he apparently gets calls all the time at pay far exceeding what he started out at. So it's nice to know that some people are willing to return if it becomes worth it to them. But, you know, as he put it to me, retirement is pretty great, and he doesn't see a need to come back.
Lydia DePillis, our guest from the New York Times, and you can join our conversation about the missing workers in our workforce at 1-800-642-1234. If this is you, or if you're a business that is feeling the pinch from the missing workers in our workforce, please, by all means, join the conversation. You can also email us ideas@WPR.org. Next group of workers that seem to be missing from our labor supply would be working age men. Where did they go, Lydia?
This isn't as severe a drop in terms of percentage, but it is a much bigger group, right? It's the folks between 25 and 54. And the men in particular, their participation rates have not returned to pre-pandemic levels, while women's, interestingly, have exceeded them, you know, and not by a ton. And like, this could change in the coming months. Some of these numbers are sort of volatile, but it is a sluggish recovery, especially with so much demand for workers out there. And, you know, it does contradict some of the you know, stories that I think are still true about women in particular having to shoulder the burden of childcare through the pandemic with all the kinds of unstable childcare and schooling available. Some of them did pull back from the workforce earlier in 2020 and 2021, but largely kept working and doing all the childcare. You know, we know from time use surveys that it's not like men were really picking up the number of hours they spent on housework. So this is sort of a puzzle, and you know, it does differ by education, and this is a cross-cutting factor. One possible cause here is that folks with college degrees, those jobs did recover in full and quickly, where people in the service sector and manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Things that are sometimes in person or making stuff, that took a lot longer. And over the years, women have outpaced college degree attainment men. And so that is partly why they may have been advantaged in this labor market. So that's another piece of it. And you know, it is interesting. There's some data to suggest that in college educated households, some men may be starting to stay home because their women might out earn them. And so if anyone decides to take some time off with the kids, it can be men, but predominantly that does tend to be women. And then there are other factors that are long running in nature that actually have been depressing male labor force participation for decades, starting long before the pandemic.
That's Lydia DePilla. She's a New York Times business reporter with us today to talk about what happened to the workers who dropped out of the workforce during the pandemic. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Is this your story? If so, join our conversation at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue, maybe hear from you as well, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking about the pandemic economy and why some workers have decided to stop working altogether. Lydia DePilis is with the New York Times Business Desk. She stays with us, has been investigating it, but we want to hear from you as well at 1-800-642-1234. Is it long COVID that's kept you from working? Have you decided your old work wasn't fulfilling and looked elsewhere? Join us, 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Erica now in Lake Tomahawk, who joins us. Erica, good afternoon. You're on the Central Time with Lydia DePilis.
Good afternoon. I'm 68 years old, and I've been trying desperately to retire for quite some time, and they can't. I haul propane in way up northern Wisconsin and up into the UP, and they simply can't find drivers. And I'm not going to throw the company under the bus. They're good people. Not everybody hires geriatric transgender truck driver.
So, Erica, you're 68 and you're looking to retire, but is the money too good to sit back right now because finding other drivers is just too tough?
No, well, they can't find drivers, and I think the loyalty is more important to me. Like I said, I don't want to throw this company under the bus. It's a small family-owned company. And they can't find people that, A, have experience, and, B, can pass a drug test.
This brings up a great point, Erica, and I thank you so much for sharing. You're driving at 68, a propane tank up in northern Wisconsin, and having a tough time filling those jobs of drivers and those with CDL licenses. What are some of the other reasons for this, Lydia? Where did the drivers go?
Well, driving, and thank you for sharing your story, Erica. That's amazing that loyalty keeps you working when you could be cooking back and you know, gardening. But so trucking is an interesting example because there was huge demand for trucks, especially in 2020 and 2021, when everybody couldn't spend on vacations and going out to concerts. So instead they ordered stuff and it had to be delivered somehow. So this is a really interesting example where, you know, people, trucking companies had been yelling about a trucker shortage, and I use air quotes here, for years. And the problem was, when you dug down into what it's like to be a truck driver, there was huge turnover because it's a really difficult job. You have to often, if you're doing long haul, be away from your families. And it can be economically precarious, especially if you're an owner operator. So, but what we started to see in 2021 was real wage increases and real freight rate, you know, increases that made it a lot more lucrative for folks to come into the industry. So they did in spades. And, you know, now we're starting to see that roll over and people are starting to have to leave the industry again. So it's very, very volatile. You know, I hope that, you know, that maybe that allows you to get a break, Erica, at some point. But, you know, people do really respond to incentives. And it was good to see companies finally give and say, if we want more people, we truly have to raise our wages.
Well, you do not need a commercial driver's license or CDL in order to drive for Uber or Lyft or take on a job in a gig economy. Is the gig economy part of the reason our labor force has not returned, Lydia, as you see it?
So there's something with the statistics here that is worth noting, which is on the Labor Department, when they calculate workforce participation, all they ask is, are you working, right? So they're not saying, they don't really, I mean, they do ask further questions about that, but gig workers should be counted as participating in the labor force, right? So that wouldn't be a reason why we're seeing depressed labor force participation. Okay. It does depress the number of payroll jobs, right? So on the other side, this is some wonky like data stuff, but when the Labor Department puts out its jobs report, the top line number of employment, that is people who are on payroll with companies. And so that would exclude gig work. So that, I do think, actually underestimates the amount of work that's happening in the economy, because people are doing work that where they're self-employed, basically. And so the data around that is also hard to parse and not fully complete, but I think there's enough sort of private indicators from companies that track this stuff to show that even if things like Uber and Lyft haven't totally rebounded because folks just don't need to be at as many places in their biggest markets like New York and Chicago, delivery drivers for platforms like DoorDash probably have expanded far above pre-pandemic levels. Although that's, you know, they keep that kind of stuff close to the vest as well. So, but it's become a sort of popular destination for workers who, I mean, and I do think this is an enduring change from the pandemic, is that folks really, you know, see that there's a lot of workers who can work from home. If they were not in a position to do that before, they're like, well, that sounds really nice. I would like to at least determine my own hours and, you know, when, and allowing me to be in school or take care of my kids. So I do think that is continuing to fuel a shift towards gig work, along with, it must be said, increasing costs, right? Like, and gig work is something that people do on top of another job that they have, rather than something that's their full-time income. And so a lot of people have been telling Uber in particular that they picked up driving shifts because they needed to cover their costs.
Dan called in, couldn't stay with us, but like Erica said, that they have found that a lot of people with small businesses are really struggling as a result of this tight labor force. What are you seeing from businesses as a result of our labor economy?
Well, so for sure, small businesses struggle with tight labor markets more than large ones for a couple of reasons. One, it's like every worker that you have is more important to you because they might be like one out of 10 people that you have as opposed to one out of 2,000. And it is often harder to compete with the wages that bigger companies offer. And especially on the low end of the labor market, you know, increasingly you're competing with the Amazons of the world that do have the liquidity to offer $15 an hour and relatively competitive benefits packages. So it is really tough for small businesses. And, you know, they, I think, are trying to compete by doing things like offering as much flexibility as they can, you know, offering their value proposition of a more sort of familial environment, something where you feel like part of a team. Another thing that I hear often, and I'm not sure how much to make of it, but is that, you know, folks, especially coming out of the pandemic, do want or would prefer a sense of mission, right? And that can make up for a lesser salary if you can cover your costs, right? If it's competitive enough that you can have a decent standard of living.
Lydia DePillis, as we look at the labor force and labor supply for businesses, what role does immigration play?
A huge one. I'm glad you asked, because that is the sort of shadow factor behind all of this. And, you know, it doesn't affect, well, it may affect slightly the sort of rate, the labor force participation rate, because immigrants do tend to have a higher share of them are, you know, work. The bigger factor is just the size of the labor force, right? Like since 2017, when the Trump administration came in and really started to crank down on both legal and illegal immigration, relative to trends before that, we don't have about 3.2 million workers that we otherwise would have if these policy changes hadn't been put in place. And you never know what, you know, there's lots of things that impact immigration, but it certainly hasn't been happening at the rates it did in the sort of 2000s, 2010s. And so those are the folks who otherwise might be working in hospitality, in restaurants and construction, and all of these sectors that are seeing some of the biggest job opening rates in the economy.
What numbers are you looking at now? What are you working on next, Lydia?
I'm looking at the rental market, actually, for housing, right? Because rental inflation is one of the biggest things driving overall inflation, and it's one of the hardest things for the Federal Reserve to really have any leverage over. And I'm particularly focused on what that means for landlords, right? Like, because it's a diverse class of people who own apartments or houses for rent. And, you know, I think there are some parts of the sector that are rolling in money and some parts that might not have had that kind of pricing power. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, with nearly double-digit increases in rents, especially in some of these big cities, where is that money going?
Lydia, we'll be watching your byline. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It was my pleasure.
Lydia DePillis, a business reporter for the New York Times, with us today to talk about how workers are faring in the economy right now and why some have dropped out of the workforce altogether. Here's some perspective for your next road trip. If you wanted to drive all the way to the end of the universe and you were traveling at a steady rate of 65 miles an hour, it would take you 480 quadrillion years to get there, or about 35 million times the age of the universe itself. Those calculations were in the New York Times this week, and the numbers were crunched by Randall Monroe. And Randall Monroe is our guest tomorrow on Central Time with more scientific answers to the most ridiculous questions, providing us, perhaps, with some valuable perspective. For example, on our road trip to the edge of the universe, we would need a gas tank the size of a moon to get there. And oil changes? Those would require enough engine oil to fill the Arctic Ocean. But don't worry, because Randall Monroe says you'll never reach your destination. The probability that you'd arrive at the end of our universe without crashing is the same as a monkey typing out the entire Library of Congress 50 times in a row with no typos. So join Randall Monroe tomorrow on Central Time as we ask him, what if our solar system was made of soup? I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, mystery writer Agatha Christie had more than a few secrets of her own. And tonight at 6 on 1A+, a revealing look at the woman behind the pages of some of our most beloved crime novels. But now, former President Ronald Reagan, often cited as having transformed the Republican Party. As we look back at the 1990s following his presidency, we do begin to see a switch in conservative politics and ideologies, often toward a far more far-right approach. One historian joins us now to talk about how Reagan, among other politicians, reshaped politics as we know them today. And, of course, we'd invite you to join our conversation at any point. Call us 1-800-642-1234. Did you vote for Reagan in the 90s? Do you still vote Republican? And did Reagan change your political affiliation? You think there's too big of a divide in politics today? 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Nicole Hemmer, an associate professor of history at Vanderbilt University who specializes in media, conservatism, and the far right. Her most recent book is Partisans, The Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. Nicole, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Lee.
Yeah, let's start with Ronald Reagan. And as you retell the history of the Republican Party through the 1990s, where do we start? Does it start with Ronald Reagan, or is Ronald Reagan a bookend of a previous chapter? How does he fit in your history?
So in many ways, people understand Reagan as the start of something new. He was the first popular landslide winning conservative president to win in the second half of the 20th century. But what I talk about in the book is the way that Reagan was fundamentally a Cold War president. He was somebody for whom the logic of the Cold War really shaped his politics, his rhetoric, his policies. And when the Cold War came to an end in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, it created this space for a new more pessimistic, less popular, more antagonistic conservatism to emerge. And that's what we see happen, is the rise of this sort of old new right that has its roots in the 1930s and 40s, but is very modern in terms of things like its use of media.
Well, and the term that comes back from the 30s and 40s that we heard in the elections in the last few years would be America First.
That's right. That's something that Pat Buchanan, who was a Republican presidential candidate in 1992 and 96, and then runs on the reform ticket in 2000, he brings that idea of America First back in his 1992 campaign. He actually writes members of the old American First Committee, this group that opposed U.S. intervention in World War II, and says, hey, I want to bring back this foreign policy that says the U.S. should not get involved in foreign entanglements, that we should be focused more on home. So it's a much more nationalistic kind of fortress America view of what the nation should be.
And Nicole, as you write in your new book, Partisans, that this America First is not anything new, but at the same time, there is the running theme of Pat Buchanan through the history of the Republican Party before the 1990s, going back to the Nixon administration, and using these phrases that would be co-opted by Donald Trump as he ran for president.
That's right. Pat Buchanan is such a fascinating figure. As you mentioned, he comes up through the Nixon administration when he was still in his 20s. He joins Richard Nixon. And at the time, he is a representative of the conservative movement in an administration that was like interested in the conservative movement, but not necessarily as far to the right as conservatives would have preferred. And so as Republican presidents get increasingly conservative, Pat Buchanan actually gets increasingly conservative as well. And he emerges in 1992 to fill what he called the political vacuum in American politics, which he saw as the space to the right of Ronald Reagan.
And Nicole Hemmer, our guest, and join us at any point, 800-642-1234. But as you write in Partisans, that Reagan Republicanism was largely a response to the Cold War and a reaction to communism and a stand against the former Soviet Union. But after the end of the Cold War, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, there was a question about what this sort of what the Republican Party would stand for and what it would be about. As we get to the 2000s, past the 1990s, how do you see the Republican Party's platform playing out after the Cold War?
So after the Cold War, particularly in the 2000s, you kind of have a Reaganism revival. People often forget this, but when George W. Bush won the election in 2000, when he becomes president, he's seen as the heir, not of George H.W. Bush, but of Ronald Reagan, his compassionate conservatism, as he liked to call it, his approach to immigration reform after the 9/11 attacks, his use of democracy as the language that was shaping his foreign policy rhetoric. All of these things reminded people of Ronald Reagan. But over the course of his presidency, you know, the democracy promotion abroad leads to the debacles in Iraq and Afghanistan. The tax cuts and deregulation help contribute to the global financial collapse. The idea that government doesn't have a role to play is really brought into question after Hurricane Katrina. And so because of the failures of the second Bush administration, you see an even bigger space for this new post-Cold War right to emerge. And that's what you see in the 20-teens with the Tea Party first and then with the rise of Donald Trump.
I have to ask, Nicole Hemmer, what role did the Democratic Party play in all this during the 1990s as you had triangulation from President Clinton, who was to some degree co-opting some conservative priorities in order to get something done during his administration? What did this do to the GOP?
Oh, it's absolutely fascinating because you're exactly right. In the 1990s, the Democratic Party really does move to the right. You see this on things like immigration. You have harsher immigration restrictions under Bill Clinton. You have people like Dianne Feinstein in California pushing for more immigration restriction. And instead of creating a kind of middle ground where Republicans and Democrats meet and come up with bipartisan legislation, what you tend to see more often is the Republican Party moving even further to the right in order to make sure that the distinctions between Democrats and Republicans remain stark. And so it has this, I think, unexpected effect of helping to push the Republican Party even further to the right in the 1990s.
1-800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guest, Nicole Hemmer, Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University and author of the new book, Partisans, the Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. And your previous book, if I'm not mistaken, Nicole, was about the conservative media, Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. When does Rush Limbaugh show up on the scene? Because for some, it would seem like he'd always been there, but he was part of the 1990 conservative movement as well, wasn't he?
He was. So that first book that I wrote, Messengers of the Right, really looked at the role that conservative media activists played during the Cold War era. Mm. And in Partisans, I look at this second generation of conservative media activists. And of course, one of those, as you mentioned, is Rush Limbaugh. His radio show goes national in 1988. And he really does fill what conservatives see as a vacuum in the wake of the Reagan administration. In fact, in 1992, after George H.W. Bush loses his reelection, Ronald Reagan writes a letter to Rush Limbaugh that says, "You are now the number one voice of conservatism in the United States." And that's the way that Limbaugh is treated, as a kind of avatar for the conservative base. During the 92 election, when Bush is not doing great in the polls, he actually invites Rush Limbaugh to the White House in order to win him over so that Rush Limbaugh will say nice things about him and hopefully bring conservatives along and make them more excited. So what you see first in Limbaugh and then in other pundits and eventually the rise of Fox News is a conservative media apparatus that is growing more and more powerful and that politicians feel they have to win over in order to win elections. That's something that's very new in the 1990s.
And as you detail in Partisans, it's Roger Ailes, late Roger Ailes, formerly of Fox News, who is cutting his teeth on TV, conservative TV media, with Rush Limbaugh as he briefly had a TV show there. I think, was that the early 90s?
That was the early 90s as well. So in 1992, when Rush Limbaugh really is at the height of his new influence, he has just written two best-selling books, and Ailes decides to pick him up for a syndicated evening television show. And it does fairly well. It plays across the country for about 4 years. And Ailes will leave that project in 1996 to go and to start Fox News. But he was absolutely instrumental in arranging things like that visit to the Bush White House, because, of course, Ailes had been a Republican consultant from the Nixon era on through George H.W. Bush.
Nicole Hemmer, our guest, Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, also a political historian who specializes in media, conservatism, and the far right. Nicole has written the books Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics, and most recently, Partisans, the Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. Want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. With the sized role of Pat Buchanan or the lasting legacy of Ronald Reagan, how do you see where the GOP stands today, and can you draw a line back through history to help explain where we are today, as opposed to some who would say that that Donald Trump was an anomaly or an outsider or an outlier? There's an argument to be made. It's part of the same language that at least Pat Buchanan used back when he was running for president in the early 90s on the Republican ticket. Tell us what you think. 1-800-642-1234. Or email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue our conversation with Nicole Hemmer next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we continue our talk with Nikki Hemmer, Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, talking with us about her new book, Partisans, in which we're diving into how conservative politics in the 90s reshaped the Republican Party that we know today. And you can join us at any point, 1-800-642-1234. Did Republican tactics or strategy from the 1990s convince you to vote Republican or Democrat? Do you think the Conservative Party is too far right from what it used to be or should be? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's turn now to Jeff in Superior, who joins us. Jeff, you're on the air with Nicole Hemmer.
Good afternoon. Before Reagan was elected president, he lived through an era where you had Robert Byrd, who was a conservative Democrat, and Barry Goldwater, who was a conservative Republican. And Ronald Reagan was a Democrat who became a Republican because he had a desire to put America on a kind of a mainstream course between those two extremes. Robert Byrd was a racist. Barry Goldwater was, you know, a little loose with military. And I think Ronald Reagan really set the pace. And that's why he won with such a landslide, was that he believed that government was there to protect us from each other. I heard him actually say that at a speech. And he believed that America was going to survive the extremes.
Jeff, I appreciate that. And Nicole Hemmer, you certainly write about this in your new book, Partisans.
That's right. Yes. One of the things that made Reagan in many ways singular in the 1980s, you know, you mentioned Barry Goldwater, and Barry Goldwater was somebody who had the same set of conservative ideas, but he couldn't make them popular. In 1964, when he ran for president, he lost in one of the biggest landslides in American history. And so what was so important about Reagan was he kind of cracked the code for how to sell conservatism to voters in a way that made it popular and actually expanded the voting base of the Republican Party. This is the era in which you hear about the Reagan Democrat. And that really does hold throughout the 1980s. And it comes apart pretty quickly by the time that you get to the 1990s. You find Republicans and conservatives holding on to a smaller and smaller share of the electorate. And so that's part of what I talk about in Partisans, how they lose their grip on that very popular conservatism of Ronald Reagan.
1-800-642-1234 to join the conversation with Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, Nicole Hemmer, whose new book is Partisans. Let's turn now to Steve in Sun Prairie. Steve, you're on Central Time. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm 50 years old, and in my lifetime, what I've seen is the media continue to move further and further, further to the left. So when you talk about activist, you know, media, you can put NPR as an activist media. And so what these other people found, the Rush Limbaughs, the Mark Bellings of the world, Fox News, there was a place where conservatives' voice could be heard and not be judged. And I wanted to know what the guest's thoughts on it. It's not so much these people are an issue. It's the fact that the media, such as NPR, have become activists. And so they created an opening for other players.
Steve, thank you. And as you mentioned this, I'm thinking about our conversation, Nicole, of the Democratic Party and Republican Party both moving towards the right in the 90s. So if everything else stayed in the middle, it could feel like it was moving to the left. As you look at it, the media landscape had a void that certainly was filled by Fox News and Rush Limbaugh. But has the media become more liberal?
Well, so it's really interesting to look at non-conservative media in the 1990s, because we think about Limbaugh, we think about Fox News as kind of the breeding grounds for conservative media. But actually, somebody like Pat Buchanan came up through PBS's The McLaughlin Group and CNN's Crossfire. People like Laura Ingraham and Ann Coulter got their start on MSNBC. And what you had in the 1990s, as you started to get cable news and a broader range of options, options as more and more Americans got cable and then the internet, is that a lot of non-conservative outlets were actually the places where conservative punditry was being born. But as you go forward into the 2000s, into the 20-teens, that begins to separate out more, that eventually you see these conservative pundits on CNN and MSNBC ultimately are going to find a home on Fox News. And what's left behind are people who aren't conservative. And so you do get something shaking out there when it comes to the different different cable news outlets and different radio outlets. There is something that conservatives were responding to in the media landscape, but they had been responding to it not since the early 1990s, but since like the early 1950s, when National Review began as a conservative magazine in 1955, it was making the exact same case that the media are too liberal and that there need to be a space for conservative voices. And so this is part of what is now, you know, a 70-year project to create this conservative media infrastructure.
Interesting, Nicole, that we're talking about the history of the Republican Party, your book Partisans, and the Republicans who remade American politics in the 1990s. And our callers are talking about the media this afternoon. Let's turn now to Steve and Stevens Point, who joins us along with our guest, Nicole Hemmer. Steve, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was just wondering what your guest thought was the influence of political satirists like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Bill Maher, and what the reaction of the Republican Party was to that political satire.
Steve, thank you. And you talk about Bill Maher and Politically Incorrect in your book Partisans.
This is such a great question. Yes, I talk about Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect because it was emblematic of a change that was happening in political media. And that is, the walls between news and entertainment were thinning so much that, you know, by the end of the 1990s into the 2000s, they were mostly non-existent. And Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect is so interesting because it would eventually end up on ABC because it was so popular, but it started off on Comedy Central. And it was the place where, in particular, conservatives hung out with actors and comedians and learned to be outrageous and funny in that setting on Bill Maher's show. Now, Bill Maher, as I mentioned, he moves to ABC in 1997. Comedy Central had really found a niche with Bill Maher, and they wanted more programming that blended politics and comedy. And that's where you get The Daily Show. That's where you get eventually the Colbert Report. And so in many ways, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are the heirs of this change that was happening in the 1990s. And Bill Maher really was the leader of a lot of that change.
Nicole Hemmer, Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University and author of the new book, Partisans, our guest. Let's go to Ben in Milwaukee now. Ben, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Another caller brought up Reagan and the different politics going on back then. And it made me think of something in my question to Mrs. Hemmers. If you think that losing the fairness doctrine gave, you know, let the guardrails down and gave rise to a more partisan landscape. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. The fairness doctrine made sure that there was a balance and equity in reporting both sides. But as that went away, was that the vacuum that allowed conservative media to grow?
So it was part of the vacuum that allowed conservative media to grow. That regulatory change happens in 1987, where under the Reagan administration, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, gets rid of the fairness doctrine. And at the time, you actually have people like Newt Gingrich and Trent Lott and Phyllis Schlafly, these conservative activists and office holders, who are like, actually, we want the fairness doctrine to be put back in place. Because by that point, there were a lot of conservatives who saw the fairness doctrine, to the point of an earlier caller, as a way of balancing out liberal media bias. Right, that you could use the fairness doctrine to say that conservatives deserved more of a say on air. It's really not until the rise of Rush Limbaugh, until he becomes this powerful figure, that conservatives are like, actually, you know what, we don't need the fairness doctrine. But I say only partially because you also needed a number of technological changes to happen to allow conservative media to flourish in the ways that it did. And I think it's the combination of the changes in regulation and technology that make it possible for conservative media to flourish in the 1990s and beyond.
Well, was it the Clinton signing of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that led to Rush Limbaugh being on over 400 stations nationwide and found just about anywhere?
So that deregulation makes a huge difference, as does, of course, technologically, the rise of the internet. So there's so much stuff that's happening on both the regulatory and technology front in this period.
We are woefully short of time, Nicole Hammer, but you end your book talking about pitchfork politics, and pitchforks and torches have made, at least verbally, an entrance into the Senate race here in Wisconsin. Can you explain what this is for us?
Sure. So pitchfork politics are this idea of, in many ways, like the people revolting. That was the image that Pat Buchanan tapped into in his 92 and his 96 campaign, that it was time to overthrow the establishment. And it's that same kind of anti-establishment politics that you're seeing there in Wisconsin, but that we're seeing across the United States as well.
Nicole Hammer, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole's an associate professor of history at Vanderbilt University, and she specializes in media, conservatism, and the far right, joining us to talk about her most recent book, Partisans, the Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it is Food Friday, so get ready. James Shen from Taste of Home magazine is bringing a list of copycat recipes from some of your favorite restaurants that will have you cooking up some meals and desserts that, you wouldn't think you'd be able to do on your own. I'm trying some of my own tonight. We'll report back tomorrow.